Major Han, Reel 10.
I think you were saying that the water came up in flimsy cans,
yes,
in trucks.
Yeah. And the same with petrol. Now, we're getting ahead of ourselves, though,
yes, we are a bit. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's just one of those things.
Yeah. I think you were saying that you lost, yes, you lost quite a lot of water.
We found on the desert. Yeah. We had all the petrol we wanted, but no water.
Right.
And then I had to come 200 or 300 miles in these flimsy little cans, trying to reach the other end. You know, the water was a quarter of what we should have. But they used to put so much petrol on, so if you start off with a full load, you might get half a load, but it's still more than you needed.
Yes.
But belts on the armed car. You had a turret, you get in through the turret. There was a separate cupola for the gunner and the commander, and a side door for the driver and anyone else could get in through the side.
If you needed to carry passengers, how many more men could you get into the Humber?
You couldn't. You could get, say, a man crouching down, but that would probably make it difficult to traverse the turret.
Mm.
So if you carried them, you might have to sit on the engine cover without.
So it was really purely a three-man vehicle.
It wasn't built for.
What was it like to drive?
It was quite good to drive. You know, it wasn't heavy. Wasn't heavy to steer or anything like that. Mm. But it was quite like any other armored car. You know, I always find that any armored vehicle is good to drive.
Mm. Well, if we're used to it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing is, when you're driving it, if anyone hits you, well, it's tough on them. But I always find that in the world it's fine.
How did you actually get out to the Middle East from Britain?
We formed up when we went to Westbury. We were billeted in a mill just down not far from where the regular commissions board is at the moment, down to the south. And we spent some time putting the armoured cars, the guns, and everything in heavy grease ready for the sea voyage. And they were then taken to the docks at Aigner-Math.
Did you go with them, or did they go separately?
They went on their own.
How were they transported down there?
Well, they were driven there.
Right.
They were driven there, and of course they were loaded by the dockers.
And when did the greasing get done?
Was that done beforehand.
Before you drove them to the docks?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it might have been a rather dirty job for the driver.
It was all done, and then of course they had closed in.
Yes.
Just driving them down and putting them on the thing. All the turret, the working parts in the turret were greased, but they wouldn't have to be touched once they were done.
Right.
It was a matter of the driver getting in and taking them. They might have had to do a little bit at the docks to finish it off, but mainly it was done with us, and certainly the guns and everything were then put into boxes.
Hmm.
The guns weren't left on the vehicles.
Did they go separately or did they go?
They went with them but separately.
Yes.
Not fixed to them. And all that sort of stuff went separately. And then we marched from Westbury to, well, from where our boats were to the railway station about 10 o'clock at night and got on the train and got the ship. At Aigner-Math, and it was not a very big ship. The whole regiment was on it, and a few RASC and sort of service troops. It was called the Highland Brigade. I think it had been a meat carrier, passenger meat carrier type thing from back and forth to the Argentine. Quite very comfortable ship, actually. We got on board
that. What sort of accommodation did you have on board?
Very good. We had bunks, cabins, which were above the troopers were all in hammocks down in the thing that took the water with the NCOs, senior NCOs, were in bunks, very comfortable. And the food was very good on board. And we stayed around England for a couple of days, and then we joined a big convoy, which was the whole of the First Army did it. And we set sail out to the Azores and right round, and I think we were about 6 weeks on board before we got to Freetown. But while we were on board, we were doing all the individual training again and that sort of thing.
Did you have any alarms for submarines?
Yes,
yeah. Or
I think every day we had action stations, boat stations and that. But
that was just a drill though, wasn't
just
it?
Just a drill. We didn't have any on board that ship. It wasn't until we got to Durban that we got one or two alarms. But certainly on that ground, it was very good.
Yeah. Any sign of enemy aircraft at any stage?
No, nothing. But there was always a huge convoy. I mean, wherever you looked, rows and rows of ships, well spaced out. And of course, a pretty strong naval escort. See the destroyers now and again, sort of spinning around. And I think we had I think the Hermes was a small aircraft carrier. We had that with us. The Argus or something like that was another one. I know I had the names of a few of them that were with us at that first part. And we got into Freetown in about 6 weeks. Freetown, then we went off to Durban. And in Durban, we were allowed off. And the South Africans treated us really well. I mean, they couldn't have been better. There were cars upon cars all waiting to take soldiers off to their houses or wherever they wanted to go. The hospitality was unbelievable. And of course, the whole city was lit up. The food was fantastic.
No wartime austerity.
And so we were allowed off for the night. The next day, we were allowed out again. And then we had to get off the boat all together. And we were taken to Sherwood Camp, which was about 20 miles outside Durban, which was the race course. And we were put into tents. And we were there for, I think, about 5 or 6 days in Durban. And then we were still allowed to go out. We did route marches during the day to get our feet back after 6 weeks on board the boat. And then we got on to the big ship, which was the New Amsterdam, which is a big liner, a beautiful liner. And on board were a part of the South African division. Lots of the nurses for the South African nurses and our regiment. And I don't know how many there on board, that was really a big liner. And we took off from there to go up the Red Sea, or past Madagascar, through the Straits. And we had the Pulse that's escorting us up there then. We got a couple of warnings when the destroyers went out and dropped depth charges when we were coming near Durban, when we were leaving Durban. But the Repulse was the battleship, battle cruiser, that was sunk out in Singapore.
That's right, the Prince of Wales and Repulse were sunk by the Japanese.
That's right, they left us and went straight round. I think they left us in November. I think they were sunk around about January or February, weren't they? The following year, which was very sad, really, but they escorted us up. and we got into Portishead. What was December? End of November,
in
41.
42,
is what you think.
It would be 41, wouldn't it? Yeah, late 41.
Yeah.
What was your first impression of Egypt when you got there?
Well, the dark roads, but in the dark, it was cold. We had to march with our kit to some camp, well away. When we got there, there was no accommodation to sleep or anything like that. We had to sort of sit out in the desert in the cold until dawn. Then we got on the train, we were taken to a camp, a tented camp, at Kepler, I think it was called. We hadn't actually seen anything to the difference. It was in the dark when we got there, and we got on the train. So all we saw was the desert, we didn't see any town or anything like that. And, we got to this area where the tents were, but we had no blankets, so we had another cold night on the desert. And the next day we got our extra blankets and things like that. Well, we had to sit around there for 2 or 3 days until we could go and get our armored cars, or the everybody in the group, but certain people were taken, the drivers were taken to go. Bring the armored cars, and they arrived. Of course, then there was a case of cleaning all the grease off and cleaning the guns and
getting them worked
up. And then taking them out on the desert and do a bit of shooting, getting the sights DNA.
Was that for zeroing? Was it?
Yes, right. Mm. Yes.
Did you have a range of any sort?
No, I just went out in the desert somewhere and put a tin can up. Mm. Use that.
At what stage had you known that you were going to Egypt? I mean, when you got on the ship.
On the ship, yes. It was a fairly good idea. And then when we got to Durban, then we were told that's where we were.
You were briefed?
Yeah.
Do you remember what you were told about?
Not really, nothing. Mm. We were just told that we were going to Egypt and that would be it. Mm. I mean, our briefing wouldn't come until, just before we went up onto the desert, to take part into. The St. Armour Division.
Had you done any training for desert operations specifically before you went to Egypt?
Not really. There's not much training we could do, really. Mm. It's just a matter of wherever you were, you apply the techniques that you've been trained to. I mean, in an army camp.
So you're just applying basic principles and learning on the job?
That's right. Mm. Yeah. As I say, once we've got our. And then we had to camouflage them to a sandy colour and black. Mm.
Did you do your own painting for that?
Yes, we did. Mm. And then we got issues with our rations and water. I say we had 6 gallons of water. We had, for each man, I think, we were issued with water and rations for 3 days for the armoured car. So what we were given was for three men for 3 days, which was 6 gallons of water, 12 packets of hard biscuits. I think 1 tin of bully beef per man per day. Right, we had 9 tins of bully. There was a tin of salted bacon, wrapped around with this grease proof paper in the tin. And so we've had any salty as water stuff. A bag which we had our tea in, sugar, and a tin of condensed milk. That was the
brew kit.
That's the brew kit. And that was the last of the 3 hours for the 3 days. There was no such thing as, there was a tin of margarine. And I think to start with, we had 2 or 3 tins of McConaughey's, the old first World War meat and stuff.
Meat and veg.
That's right. That was, we had that to start with. And
presumably you'd had McConaughey's before.
Yes, on exercise and things like that.
So you knew what to expect.
Yes. And I think basically that's all we had. There's all sort of treats like ginger jam or anything like that. And so then we were, once we got our rations, the cars were ready. On the 6th of December, we moved out into the desert, the whole regiment.
Did you know where you were heading for when you set off?
We were just, not, names didn't mean anything really. We were told, you know, we were going to a certain area, a map reference type thing, you know.
As part of 7th Armoured do.
That's right, yeah. And we went, each squadron in arrowhead formation, the troops in arrowhead formation, twice side the whole regiment, which we would say there was, what, 12 cars? About 12 cars per squadron, so it's 30, about 40 odd.
40 vehicles altogether.
Armoured cars. Then you had all the echelons. You had the whole echelons with you at that time, all moving up. And the echelon used to be quite hefty, three forwards, and I shouldn't have had almost the same number of lorries and LED lorries and stores and all that.
Fitters truck and so on.
Yeah. So it's quite a big.
Would it amount to about 100 vehicles altogether? Something like that?
Not far off. And you can imagine that spread out, and the sand and the dust. And I think we motored for about 3 days.
Have you got any idea of the sort of area of ground that you covered, you know, when you were deployed on that basis?
Well,
how much space did you need to?
Well, the space wasn't the problem.
Of course.
I think the more, as we learned later, the more space that you took, the safer you were.
Of course.
And so therefore we did spread quite a lot. And the colonel sort of always used to insist, no bunching, and that. So certainly within the troop, you would travel at least 200 yards apart from your other vehicles.
So across the front of the regiment, when you're moving up like that,
you'd reckon, I reckon if you said a mile.
Yes.
And then that would be coming back again, you'd have that space between each thing. So I say, but there was no problem there, because there was nothing there, it was just flat, and you just went. And as I say, we always practice in the regiment that you would make sure that it was lots of space between you and the other people. In case you were bombed, at least then only one of you perhaps would be hit and not the whole troop.
How fast were you moving when you moved?
We were traveling at least 30 miles an hour. No, because that was good ground, good going, at least 30 miles an hour.
Did you have trouble with station keeping at all?
Not really, no. No, and the vehicles travelled well. I can't know anybody travelling in the squadron.
And you were able to maintain the distances and the layout on the move?
Yeah. Well, once you got your, say, squadron with each point, you were doing the map reading.
Yes. And the others were following on behind.
Yeah. Everybody didn't. Once you got one man who was doing it, then the others sort of just followed on.
When you were doing this kind of move, did you have regular stops?
Yes. There would be at least, we used to try to stop about every 2 hours, just to check that everything was all right, quick look around the vehicle and stretch your legs and give anyone who wanted to smoke the chance to stand out and have a smoke. And,
how long would you stop for, that regular 2 hour?
Well, if you're going to eat, you probably have a half an hour. But if it's just a check, 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you go.
What did you do at night? Did you carry on at night or did you stop?
Well, each squadron then would form a Kilsliga.
Yes.
Each squadron well away from each other. And then that would mean all the armed cars would form a square with the guns outwards. All the soft vehicles would be in the middle. And, you know, you would lose the tail. So it's just a little block.
Yeah.
And all facing the same way. So if you had to move, everyone.
You could take off at a moment's notice.
Right. And you used to sleep inside the wheel of your arm and arm. It would be inside the leader and sleep at the side of the vehicle with the blankets on the floor. And you would have, say, a man from each troop on guard, sort of patrolling around.
So you had sentries walking around,
right.
Yes.
Just to listen to. In case anything came along.
Did you ever dig slip trenches overnight?
No.
For security?
No. Yeah. Well, our security was, if anything happened,
move.
You see, there's no good digging slip trenches, because all your armour and your guns and everything were up there. So if there's the slightest thing, the door was, you're straight in the armour car and ready to fire. All the guns would be pointing outwards.
Did you have any trouble at all at night?
No.
So you said you were driving for three days. You had a couple of overnight stops.
Yeah.
And presumably you were moving forward into the.
I think on the third day we were then split up.
Yes.
Each squadron was given its sector, so we didn't see anything of them. Each troop was given its task.
Within the squadron sector. And at this time you were still a troop, you were troop sergeant.
That's right, yes. And I think the first, I think, four troop which I was in.
Right.
We were the first ones to be bombed. And the first ones to be shelled. And I think the following day we got General Gort. I think it was Commanding 7th Army did at the time, wanted to go up to the front and have a look, see, you know, the layout. So he was standing on the back of Matt Abraham's car, who was a troop leader, and our other two cars, myself and the corporal, we were out on the place.
Yeah.
And we were going on quite happy, and suddenly bang, anti tank gun opened up. And Matt's car, actually. So our immediate action was smoke. In the direction of the smoke first, and then machine gun. You know, because you've got your cover.
Yes.
And then.
And you fire through the smoke.
Through the smoke, or if you can get a pickup, general direction. You wouldn't see it anyway, probably. But certainly, if you've got the general direction, then you smoke and fire. At least it's going to keep the hits down, and if we did that, at least we would have known.
How would you work out where it was? Was it by the sound?
The sound, and you probably might see the smoke, or you might see the flash.
Yes.
You know, it's, but you know the general direction.
Did you see it? See the flash on this occasion, or?
No, I heard the.
I heard the report of the gun.
The report in the general direction. So straight away, you fired your smoke in that general direction.
Yes.
And if all of us did it, then you've got a smoke screen. At least it stops him from taking a second shot at the armoured car. And if you fire then, at least then you are sort of done.
Some suppressive effect.
Well, they're not going to think, well, we've got all our way.
Yeah.
See, so that was the idea, really. And then, of course, when you withdraw, once you. Got an anti-tank gun. He's heavier than you, and he's going to knock you out. And we had the general with us, which we didn't want
to lose the general, no. But
otherwise, I think we'd have been in bad. So, as I say, that was our first. Oh, and just after that, I saw some distance away some men walking. You know, two men from the Royals. And I think they'd lost their arm again. I've been to buy the same anti-tank gun, I don't know. Mm. So I went and picked them up and brought them back and got them back at headquarters in that line.
Do you have any idea of what sort of range the gun was shooting at, the anti-tank gun?
Well, normally I should say it was somewhere in the region of 1,000 yards. Mm. Might have been 1,200 yards, but it was around about 1,000.
Do you know what sort of gun it was?
No. Mm. We assumed it was a 50mm. Mm. This 50mm was there. Normal one, not there. It certainly wasn't an 88.
Mm.
Because I think if it had been an 88, it would have got us.
Yes.
One of the armoured cars. Because they were so deadly accurate. So it was one of the smaller anti-tank guns.
How many days have you been in the desert when that happened?
That was our first day in action.
Yes. So you had 3 days of moving up.
I've been 2 days and this was the third day.
On the third day you were straight into action. Yes. Had you seen any signs that you were entering an area of active operations?
No.
Just empty desert still?
Just empty desert. That was the thing about the desert. You could go for miles. Mm. And just out of the blue, you didn't know where the enemy could cross.
Did you know where you were? In,
oh, yes, we knew where we were. Yeah. And we knew it was an area where we got to... I mean, we didn't go blinding on. I mean, we were moving sensibly. Mm. You know, sort of, and this anti-tank gun could have been in a little fold in the land.
Yes.
And seen it. Couldn't see it. And, but we were prepared. You know, it wasn't as though it came as a complete shock that we were. And I think it was the following day then we saw a tank.
Yes.
And then from then on we started being shot at.
Mm.
You know, and shelled.
Did you have good maps of the area?
Well, I don't know if they were good in those days, but the map didn't show very much, you see. All it showed was an odd track.
Mm.
The rest was just sand and there was nothing there.
No landmarks?
No landmarks to speak of. What they started to do in the desert was to put up barrels with a number on it. And that would then later, when we got a different map, be shown. That was barrel 52 or 50. And they were... it might be 20 mile apart or something like that. Mm. But at least it gave you a map reference, you know, to confirm
where you were.
Exactly where you were. It was a good thing. Because the trouble was, if you were being shot at, you would be shooting off that direction, then you'd be shooting that way and that way. And you weren't bothered about your map, particularly at the time. You were more concerned about the enemy and
of course.
And that sort of thing. So if you weren't careful, you could have done a few mile out and you say, now where am I?
Yes.
And you haven't got a somewhere where you can say, well, I'll take a bearing on that and then work out where you were, because I have nothing like that. So a lot of it, you weren't 100% sure that you were in that particular map reference until you could find somewhere where you could take a map, take a bearing and confirm it. There's no really sophisticated sort of things up in the sky where you can.
No satellite navigation in those days. Did you know who you were supporting particularly? Who did you report to?
We didn't actually report to anyone ourselves. It was commanding officer.
Yes.
Who would then, he was under some kind of division.
Right.
And he would have been told, protect our flank.
Yes.
And so we were given the task, which I you were on that flank. This is what you're doing, you're protecting the flank. Any enemy over there, we want to know about.
Roughly what sort of sector were you covering with your squadron? Did you have an idea of what, you know, how long the front was that you were supposed to be screening?
Not really, because I think at the time, the first thing, they were moving.
Yes.
You see, and you knew that your particular troop had a particular area to do, which you would work out, say, about half a mile from each armoured car.
So you were a wide screen then? Yeah. Just,
and the next troop, you'd probably see them, the first armoured car, about half a mile, and the same to your left. So you could cover a large area. You could probably do more than a mile, depending on
the ground.
The ground, well, not so much the ground because it was flat. but the visibility as well. You see.
What sort of things will affect visibility?
Well, you might get sandstorm, dust, a slight haze. But you try to keep, you would always, anyway, keep the car on your far side, the troop, in sight, and you keep the car of your troop in sight, which would probably be the troop leader in the middle, and then he would keep an eye on his other car on the right,